Hello, this is Ken McLeod. Just a quick reminder that my latest book, A Trackless Path, is now available at unfetteredmind.org. If you are interested in spiritual practice as a way of life, you will find this book on Dzogchen to be both relevant and helpful. To coincide with the book's release, we are also posting 5 Nuts and Bolts podcasts on the same topic. Here is the 3rd in the series, The Nuts and Bolts of What to Do When a Thought Arises. In the first 3-year retreat that I did, head of the Kagyu Order, Karmapa, the 16th, came to visit us. And during that time, he gave us what are called the pointing out instructions. And here's what he said. Look and as soon as the thought arises, relax. Then look. And as soon as the thought arises, relax. Look. And when thought arises, relax. Now, when he was giving those instructions, they had all of the subtlety of being picked up by the scruff of your neck and thrown against the wall. So when he said, look, it went, and then relax. Now, he's just sitting in his throne repeating these words, but that's what it was like. Right there. And then relax. Right there. And relax. You work this way. You build capacity. It requires quiet determination, a great deal of patience. You also find that after a certain point, you can't do it anymore. That means you've run out of juice for that period of meditation. There's an old adage, don't flog a dead horse. At this point, you're a dead horse. There is no point in trying. It's actually counterproductive. You do something else. That said, you rest with the breath, read some prayers, go for a walk, whatever. You refresh yourself. And then you come back. How many of you carry in you an image of sitting indefinitely, completely awake and present? Yeah, just forget it. Very problematic image to carry.
So when working with these instructions, short periods, really clear, mic's gone. Okay, did anything? Okay. Or what? Short periods. When battery. Okay. So short periods, you set the intention, no wandering, no control, no working at anything. And when you do that, and I'm going to give you some other methods for making that shift, there's a shift. That's what Karmapa was referring to, or directing. Is when he said, you look. There's a shift that happens. But it doesn't last. It dissipates. When it dissipates, don't try to hold on to it. Don't try to bring it back. Let go completely. That's what he meant when he said, relax. And then do it again. There's a very strong tendency in people who practice meditation to try to hold to mental states or experiences that arise. In the way that I was trained, this was always regarded as counterproductive. Whether it was Four Immeasurables, Yidam Practice, Mahamudra, you name it. When the quality of attention, quality of experience dissipate, don't try to hold on to it. Let it go. Relax. And then do it again. All of you have heard me when I talk about basic meditation. Return to what is already there and rest. And put the emphasis on returning, not on trying to hold on to. That holding on to inevitably creates a tension, which results in suppression and all kinds of other really problematic dynamics. Aim of this kind of practice is for natural awareness to be able to express itself in our lives. In order for natural awareness to express itself, we can't be doing something unnatural. That may sound trivial and obvious, but it's amazing how convoluted we can make these things. And I know very well from my own experience, because I really tried to hold on to stuff in a very unproductive way for a very, very long time. So if I can save you a few years, I'll be quite happy. And I mean years. In the booklets that you have, if you turn to page 13, actually we can take a look at page 12. the longest paragraph on page 12. These are instructions from my teacher. Let mind settle naturally. And that's really what body like a mountain, breath like the wind, mind like the sky are pointing to. Letting the whole system settle naturally. Don't control it. Just recognize it. Now, this is kind of interesting. We all have a mind, we say. How much attention do we pay to it normally? Not very much, just runs amok, right? So, right now, just recognize your mind. What happens when you do that? Do it again. Just relax. Just recognize it. What happens? Once more. Just relax, look around the room. And then just recognize your mind. Okay, what happens? Leah?
Well, there is an immediate focus.
Focus?
Yeah, just a presence.
Were you focused on anything?
No, maybe that's not the right word.
Okay, and that's why I wanted to point it out. We say focus, but it's actually not a focus on anything. But there's a shift.
There's, yeah, clarity or something. Well,
yeah.
Presence is the best word. Just everything synced up.
Okay, anybody else? Nancy, to your left. Right, sorry.
I experience it as sort of the mind relaxing. Just sort of...
Opening.
Opening.
Yeah, okay. Anybody else? Tom.
I experience it as an energetic shift.
Okay. Anybody have no sense of this whatsoever? Okay, good. Then Rinpoche writes, if you stay right there, mind on its own is empty, clear, unrestricted, luminously radiant. Now, you may not get all of that first take, but you practice this again and again. As Leo was describing, hard to put into words. She decided to use the word presence. Other people had other descriptions. But you come to experience that when you just recognize mind, there is nothing there. That's the emptiness aspect. But it's not simply nothing there. because there's a quality of knowing. That's the clarity aspect. And everything's there. As Leah said, everything just synced up, right? Everything's there. That's the unrestricted part. So you don't have to seek any of that stuff out, and that's really important. And even more important, don't try to make any of it that way. There's an expression that I came across which applies here. You can't wake up somebody who is pretending to sleep. You can't make mind empty. You can't make mind clear. It's impossible. Because it is empty and it is clear. So don't try to make it that way. That just produces an artificial, contrived experience. You recognize. And rest right there. In the beginning, you'll only be able to rest there for very short periods of time. That's just how it is. In the Mahamudra text it says, you rest there for the time it takes for you to swallow. So, of the order of 1 second. But that's where everything starts. Rinpoche goes on. Although all kinds of thinking may arise, attraction, aversion, so on, if you rest, just recognizing what is there, it, that's the thinking, will release itself naturally and have no effect on you. How many of you have had this experience? Let's try a little experiment. Think of something that made you angry in the last week. Recall the situation. Let the anger come up. It will be an echo, but it will probably be sufficient for our purposes. And when the anger's up, just recognize it. What happens? Anybody? Tom?
It dissipated.
Anybody else? Yeah. Sounds easy, doesn't it? No, that's not too hard because it's an echo. You develop sufficient capacity and attention. And even quite strong anger transforms in the moment in exactly the same way. Very important point. You don't transform the anger. And if anybody, you hear anybody bragging about how they're able to transform their emotions, you know they're full of bullshit. The transformation takes place quite naturally, in fact, completely naturally, when there is a sufficient level of attention. You don't have a thing to do with it, which is very disturbing to our egos, but Rinpoche goes on. It's like water and waves. When there's a sufficient level of attention, emotions come and go, and it's the movement of mind. If you keep that empty, clear, radiant, unrestricted, present mind, that's Mahamudra. Now there's about five or six sentences here. Meditation instructions, meditation manuals are very, very deceptive in the way they're written. We've gone through about five sentences here. This is anywhere from 6 months to 1 year of consistent work. By consistent work, I mean like 6 to 8 hours a day. When you're reading meditation manuals, they do not give any indication, usually, of how long it takes for these things to unfold. Because we read things literally, we think, oh, well, that, then that, then that, then that. And we're very upset and disturbed when it doesn't just happen, you know, all in the same day or in the first time we sit down. What is implicit in here is that doing this again and again builds a capacity. And then these things take place quite naturally. Because what we're talking about here is building a capacity to experience things a different way. We can't really say how things are, it's impossible. Right now we experience things as subject, object, and thoughts and emotions tumbling and crashing through our minds and us getting carried away by them and confused and unclear in our actions as a result. But by applying ourselves to this kind of practice, we can develop the ability to experience things in a very, very different way. That is, when the mind is quiet and clear, then everything appears as an expression of mind. And mind itself there's nothing there. And this leads us into a very, very different way of life. And it's basically why most of us are here. I want to go back and pick up one piece, because I've talked a lot about mind. We go back to the instruction, mind like the sky. I want to change it now. And you tell me what effect this has on you. Heart like the sky. Heart like the sky. What effect does that have for you? Larry?
It's easier to access, I think. I think it's, for me, it's easier to access.
What happens? First, when you say heart like the sky, where does the tension come from?
I feel attention dissipating.
Yes, attention. Where does it feel like attention comes from? Valerie?
When you said heart like sky, my energy, which had been up here in mind like sky, dropped down. My heart opened up, and I felt like a warm expansion.
Okay. Larry's going, yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. Well said.
Okay. So, let's go through this again now. Let your heart settle naturally. Don't control it. Just recognize your heart. Stay right there. Your heart on its own is empty, clear, unrestricted, luminously radiant. Although all kinds of feelings may arise, if you rest, just recognizing what is there, they release themselves naturally and have no effect. What's that like? Tom?
I have exactly the opposite reaction to these other two.
Okay.
It terrifies me. And it's like a place I don't really know where to go.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So you practice this way. Why am I telling you to do that?
Why?
Yeah. Microphone, please.
Because I need to be practicing that way.
Why do you say that?
I don't know. I think in my practice, I go where it's easier for me. And this idea of opening my heart is difficult.
Yeah. Anybody else? Claudia.
You just gave us a demonstration of what you said this morning. You said the emotional quality in your practice is very, very important.
Yeah. I like to be a little consistent now and then. Nancy.
I can't tell the difference. They
okay.
seem the same to me.
All right. You've practiced a long time, though. when you practice a long time, you realize the mind just isn't the intellect. It does include feelings. So, yeah. Anybody else? Joan.
For me, it felt softer and more open.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, we have this unfortunate division in English. Whenever you hear people talking about mind, remember heart. It may make a small difference in how you practice. Very important. Now, Leslie, please.
Why do you translate it as mind?
Well, I translate it in three ways, depending on context. Sometimes I translate it as mind. Sometimes I translate it as heart. Though I have to be careful with that. And other times I translate it as experience. And somebody came to see me the other day, and the first time she had a background in Theravadan practice. And so I said, just take a simple object, and we can all do this right now. And, you know, it can be a pen, a piece of paper, whatever you want. So we'll do this in two ways. Focus on it. Focus your attention on the object you've chosen. Okay? Let that go. Now, open to the experience of this object. How's that? Anybody experience any difference there? What was the difference you experienced? Leslie? Paul, could you pass up to Leslie, please? Can you hold it like this?
The okay. Focusing on is the narrow vision and telescopic vision, and the opening two is wide.
Okay.
And it's more body.
More
me.
Body, okay.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Janet?
I found that when I was focusing, there was tension in my belly. And when I was opening to, it wasn't there. The tension wasn't there.
Okay.
More just broadly aware and opening to and constricted and focusing.
Sometimes I leap into stories about the object. The object starts having its own agenda, story, whatever.
So what's the difference between focusing on and opening to for you?
Well, focusing, it's just the thing, sort of inert.
Mm-hmm.
But if I open to it, then it can be almost anything else.
Okay, so I want you to go a step further. Open to it and don't go into the stories. What happens then?
then when everything's equal.
Yeah, okay. Anybody else? Joan.
With focusing, it's more, for me, more looking at, more the subject-object, and opening to it, it was less distinction.
Mm-hmm. How many else of you found that? Okay. So, that's a demonstration of the problem in translation. So it's very, very important. Valerie, throw out all the books, burn them.
I'm sorry, Ken. It's just that I think I was talking about it from the other direction.
Yes.
In that, because we're habituated by our language itself to think mind, heart, how do we join what has been rent asunder? And maybe Josephine is a person to ask that question, since she's experienced both. I don't know.
Well, you remind me of a quotation I came across recently. Language begins with the death of the individual. Language presents the illusion of being able to share experience. But each of us has our own experience, and we can't trade it, exchange it, give it, or share it with anybody else. You follow? In the course of our practice, I think it's a very interesting point you've raised. We will repeatedly discover how our the language that we've adopted, used, etc., limits how we can experience things, which is why there's so frequent reference to there's an experience that can't be described. Now we're actually moving into our experience. We will, through that, we will actually find a different way to use language. But before that, you might say that our practice is opening up the possibility of being in our experience without the dependence of language. And that creates a very different world. This resonate with you at all? Okay. Any comment? You have to use words. Wow. If you one of those words usually works, but we've created a very strange beast in English. In our Buddhist vocabulary. Because we talk about mind as if it was something other than us. You know, and mainly I translate it that way because that's fairly standard translation, though. But it's also because it has the problems, that's why I try to remember to take the time to point out that there's a whole other side that people tend not to relate to because of the word mind. And that emotional quality very, very important. Some people have experimented with translating as mind/heart. That doesn't really work. It actually makes things worse. So I don't know what the solution is. We're better off than German, because they only have one word, Geist, which is the same word for ghost.
How about a new word?
Any suggestions? Mart? Hind? No, both of those words are already taken. Okay, Valerie.
And where does awareness fit in? I guess I'm confused because I think of awareness as all of it. Is the bigger, and somehow mind is thinking. Well, sometimes the way you use it, it's interchangeable, so it's confusing.
We've actually got quite a rich vocabulary in English compared to other Western languages. Awareness puts the emphasis on the knowing quality. And works perfectly well, but that's usually a translation for words like rigpa in Tibetan, vidya in Sanskrit. Where there's an explicit emphasis on the knowing quality in experience. Okay? I mean, to some extent, these are all arbitrary choices, but...
It's kind of a problem, though, because how we name things is how we experience them.
Yes. You're completely right here, and so we move here into a rather a different topic, but it's probably good to spend some time on it. The way things are translated shapes how people practice to a far greater extent than most people realize. When this last winter, I started work on a book on translation. And I thought, okay, let's dig up some theory of translation. And I typed theory of translation into Google and hit return. Guess what came up? Pardon? No. No. Thousands and thousands. All about translation of the Bible, which has been the central translation problem in Western history. And it's a no-brainer when you think about it. That is the last thing I was expecting. The first translation of the Bible from Aramaic into Greek, I think it was called the Septuagint, was a really bad translation. You have no idea how many theological problems started with that bad translation. So the influence of translation on how things are understood is huge. It's a very good point to raise. It's one of the reasons I still continue to translate, because I like refining translation so they get closer to communicating what I think is really intended. As far as I can tell, very relatively few translators pay that kind of attention. And people who don't have knowledge of the source languages are completely at mercy, at the mercy of the translators. And many of the people who now teach have learned vocabulary which is basically first generation, maybe second generation of translation, and now assume that that is the best vocabulary. So we have, and I said, I talked about this at the very beginning of this retreat, in the meditation instructions and commentaries on meditation, you find the definition of mindfulness is the mind, and you can also say heart here, joining with the object of attention. And then people are told to concentrate on, focus on. Now, when you're concentrating on something, focusing on something, how do you join with it? Becomes very problematical. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why, in my own practice, but also how I work with people, is I never talk about focusing on or concentrating on, because I think it points people in absolutely the wrong direction. And I tend to talk much more about opening to or including, because those don't foreclose the possibility of joining with. If you see what I mean. And then somebody came to see me the other day, and the first time, she had a background in Theravadan practice. And so I said, just take a simple object, and we can all do this right now. And, you know, it can be a pen, a piece of paper, whatever you want. So we'll do this in two ways. Focus on it. Focus your attention on the object you've chosen. Okay? Let that go. Now, open to the experience of this object. How's that? Anybody experience any difference there? What was the difference you experienced? Leslie? Paul, could you pass up to Leslie, please? Can you hold it like this?
The focusing on is the narrow vision and telescopic vision, and the opening to is wide.
Okay.
And it's more body.
More body, okay.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Janet?
I found that when I was focusing, there was tension in my belly. And when I was opening to, it wasn't there. The tension wasn't there.
Okay.
More just broadly aware and opening to and constricted and focusing.
Sometimes I leap into stories about the object. The object starts having its own
mm-hmm.
agenda, story, whatever.
So what's the difference between focusing on and opening to for you?
Well, focusing, it's just the thing, sort of inert.
Mm-hmm.
But if I open to it, then it can be almost anything else.
Okay, so I want you to go a step further. Open to it and don't go into the stories. What happens then?
Then when everything's equal.
Yeah, okay. Anybody else? Joan.
With focusing, it's more, was for me, more looking at, more the subject object, and opening to it, it was less distinction.
Mm-hmm. How many else of you found that? Okay. So, that's a demonstration of the problem in translation. So it's very, very important. Valerie. Throw out all the books. Burn them.
I'm sorry, Ken. It's just that I think I was talking about it from the other direction.
Yes.
In that, because we're habituated by our language itself to think mind, heart, how do we join what has been rent asunder? And maybe Josephine is a person to ask that question, since she's experienced both. I don't know.
Well, you remind me of a quotation I came across recently. Language begins with the death of the individual. Language presents the illusion of being able to share experience. But each of us has our own experience. And we can't trade it, exchange it, give it, or share it with anybody else. You follow? In the course of our practice, I think it's a very interesting point you've raised. We will repeatedly discover how our the language that we've adopted, used, etc., limits how we can experience things, which is why there's so frequent reference to there's an experience that can't be described. Now we're actually moving into our experience. Through that, we will actually find a different way to use language. Before that, you might say that our practice is opening up the possibility of being in our experience without the dependence of language. And that creates a very different world.
Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.